What I'm going to talk about is something that is fairly broad in nature, but I'm going to focus it on a problem that, of course, originally came from Boeing, where I work. We, as you know, probably make airplanes. And when we make an airplane, when we build a new airplane, typically what we have to do is do flight testing. And by flight testing, we mean we build the very first airplane, and we go out and see if, in fact, the airplane flies the way we expect it to fly. Well, it usually doesn't, and so usually there's some minor changes that have to be made based on the flight testing. Now, this is an extremely big problem. There's an entire organization at the Boeing company doing data processing of flight test data. Every time there's a new Boeing airplane, when you make a new variation of a 767 and you go to a 767ER, that means new flight test. And every flight test that you perform has to be done to within tolerances. There's certification requirements. The data that you gather has to be certified by the FAA before you can actually sell an airplane. So this is an extremely important problem. And the way it's done right now is rather crude. So what I'm going to talk about is some more, I guess, modern ideas that we're trying to bring to the bear on this particular problem. But it does have applications in all other arenas. And in fact, I'll try to emphasize that as we get on in the talk. Okay, parameter estimation in its simplest form. What do I mean? I mean that we have a system that's described by a model, a mathematical model. In our applications, it'll be a set of ordinary differential equations, but it could be partial differential equations. And inherent in that model are some parameters that define the behavior of the dynamics. By large scale, I mean that we have a lot of parameters that we need to determine. And what we're trying to do is determine those parameters such that our math model matches the observed situation, whatever it is. Observations from flight test data, in our example, could be radar sightings, it could be measurements from telemetry, whatever. So to focus this, I'm going to kind of give you an idea of how people have traditionally done this. And I do mean traditional in this sense, that Gauss was doing this 200 years ago when he talked about least squares parameter estimation and trying to determine orbits. Basically, what was done and is probably done in a lot of applications right now is you take a guess at the parameters. And using that guess of the parameters, you then do something like fly a simulated trajectory. You simulate your model, and then you check and see, does your simulated trajectory match the observations? If it does, you're done. If it doesn't, then you've got to make a new guess for the parameters and repeat. Okay, that's a pretty straightforward concept. You can see we're going to be going through a loop here. We're going to perhaps do this many times. The difference is that we're going to be talking about problems with lots of parameters. And by lots, actually, the example I'm going to give you is 75 parameters, but in fact, we're looking at applications with 75,000 parameters as being a lot to estimate. Typically, we're going to be talking about very complicated models, and so this is kind of just a demonstration of the kind of problem that we're really looking at. Okay, to still focus a little more tightly on a real application, this is actually a problem that comes out of the literature. It was done 30 years ago by Arthur Bryson, and it's kind of one of the standard application problems that appears in optimal control literature. Basically, he was looking at defining aerodynamics for an F-4 Phantom, an old fighter airplane that's no longer produced, actually. And if you look at that particular mathematical description, it has inherent in its model formulas for the drag and the lift. These are, you know, fundamental aerodynamic characteristics of the vehicle. And specifically, if you look at the formula, I've actually written down the functional forms for the equations that are used in this particular model. You'll notice we've got a quantity here called a drag coefficient, a lift coefficient, and the drag and lift are proportional to velocities, but over in the second equations here, what we've got is some quantities that are represented as functions of the Mach number. That's a property of the, essentially a function of the velocity. Okay, typically when you specify a particular vehicle, you have a whole host of tabular data that defines quantities that go into the vehicle description. And this is, in fact, what's done in a commercial aircraft. You have very complicated sets of tabular functions that describe, as in this example, aerodynamics, propulsion characteristics, structural properties, control properties, and so forth. So for our simple example, I'm going to take a case where we've got three curves to look at, and I'm going to actually use a representation for those curves that is used in our current modeling, and we're going to use a parametric B-spline representation. So what we have is a way to specify these quantities that appear in our drag and lift formulas in terms of a finite set of parameters, the P sub L's and the P sub D's and P sub A's. Those are the parameters we're going to try to estimate. Okay. The dynamics of the system then involve these quantities. So on the right-hand side, we're going to have drag and lift appearing as forces that would change the translational and rotational, in this case actually just translational motion. And so I've written it in this form. We've got y dot as a vector of quantities that are used to describe the dynamics. In this particular case, the set of state variables is the altitude, longitude, and latitude, velocity, flight path angle, and azimuth. So we have three components that locate the position of the vehicle and three components that determine the velocity vector. In addition to that, I'm treating these aerodynamic functions as algebraic quantities so that we actually are writing the dynamics or describing the dynamics in terms of a set of differential algebraic equations. So we have a set of nonlinear DAEs, and we've got a bunch of parameters here, a list of quantities P that are to be defined. Okay? Now, this is the objective function, and this kind of tells the whole story in a way. It's a big, ugly-looking thing. It's got three summations on it, but it really kind of, as I say, captures the essence of the whole problem. What we're looking at here is data, the y-hats, and we have that data gathered, and we have some simulated quantities, y, evaluated at a series of times. Okay, now we have a summation here running over three indices. So what we're going to try to do is look at data from three test trajectories. So we're going to simultaneously take this vehicle and fly it with a right turn straight ahead and a left turn. Actually, what we're doing is we're flying three trajectories that are a high angle of attack, a moderate angle of attack, and a low angle of attack trajectory. These are three different sets of trajectories that have information about the dynamics. So we want to match data from three different trajectories at the same time. We've got 1,000 data points gathered along the trajectory. So on each trajectory, we're going to sample the altitude every so often at 1,000 different points, and the velocity at all those points. And in fact, all of the variables are going to be measured at all those points. So we have an index K running over all of the dynamic variables. And that's the quantity we want to minimize. So to reiterate then, what are we trying to do? We're trying to compute the parameters that define the spline characteristics such that we minimize that objective function, minimize the error between the simulated trajectory and the test data, and then, of course, we have to satisfy those differential equations. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, we didn't want to begin this whole problem on real commercial airplane data. In fact, we're in the process right now of just demonstrating to the folks that are doing this the current way that it can be done. So we constructed what I call a dry lab experiment. And the way we can do that is we can just assume we know what the values of the spline coefficients are. In other words, assume we know the parameters and call that truth. Then we could go off and we could numerically integrate those differential equations and save off a trajectory profile for each case, a right turn, center, and left turn case. So we have a saved trajectory, a y tilde, and then we can turn around and say, okay, now to construct and mimic the real situation, we're going to add in noise, and so we'll know what truth is in our dry lab experiment, and we can add in noise at arbitrary levels and just see if this whole idea works, see if it hangs together. Okay, so the first thing we tried was the case where we have no error. You'd like to be able to, given the output of the system, reconstruct the input essentially, and this is essentially a plot of the results we obtain. Okay, the top curves are those spline parameter curves that we're estimating. You'll notice we've got C sub L as a function of Mach number. Mach number goes from 0 up to about 1.8. And the CD0 and eta curves are the same range. So that's saying that we could estimate the quantities reasonably well. And in fact, to show that we're doing it reasonably well, on these bottom curves, we're actually plotting the percentage error between the fitted function and the truth model that we know. And you'll see, in fact, there's nothing even plotted here. The percentage error here is 0.2%, which says, in fact, we're getting a pretty decent fit when we don't have any noise. Okay, and that's kind of heartwarming. It says that, yeah, the whole concept is going to hang together, at least in the perfect case. There is something to note here, by the way. Even in the case when we have no error, you'll notice that we're getting a little bit of a deviation from truth in the regions at the very beginning here. What is that? That's Mach 0. Mach 0 means velocity is 0, and at that regime, we have no data because airplanes don't fly at 0 velocity. Okay, so we have a fundamental issue to deal with here. You're trying to reconstruct properties when you have no data. Okay, so that's something we have to think about. Well, the next thing we said was, okay, let's see what happens if we put in some realistic noise on the data. Now, in this case, realistic noise we could control with that random number generator. And so what we're looking at here is deviations in the altitude of plus or minus 50 feet, deviations in the velocity on the order of a half of a foot per second. This is the kind of a typical measurement error that you would actually encounter in perhaps a real flight test. So this is kind of a realistic set of data. And you'll notice now what's happening is that we're getting the basic shape except in the regions, Mach 0, where we're getting 80% error in that case. Well, again, this is telling us you've got no data, you're going to have trouble estimating the data or estimating the functions where you have no information. And in fact, this is a fundamental dilemma that you're going to have to deal with. Well, what are we going to do about it? Well, in the real world, out in the community of 200 or 300 flight test engineers, they know that their aerodynamic models shouldn't have that behavior at Mach 0. So they actually impose constraints based on engineering knowledge, heuristics, 30 or 40 years of experience, whatever. But essentially what they're going to do is do things like this. They're going to say, well, gee, as you approach Mach 0, you'd like the asymptotic behavior of those curves to be flat. You don't want the things to be going wild. So how do we impose that mathematically? We say, well, let's require that the slope, the partial derivative of that curve with respect to Mach number, evaluated at Mach equals 0, is 0. In other words, we want to asymptotically come into an end point flat. Well, another criteria they also have observed over the years is that these curves tend to be monotonic functions of Mach number. So this is another typical geometric property that engineering or physical insight would bring to the problem. And we can impose a constraint like that just as well. So this turns out to be a second set of conditions. Actually, there are a bunch of inequality constraints. And what I've actually done now is I've introduced equality and inequality constraints in terms of our unknown parameters. So what we're going to be looking at now is an inequality constrained problem. What happens when we actually incorporate that information? Okay, here's what a constrained fit looks like. Now what you're seeing is a very good representation of all the curves. The maximum percentage error here is 0.1%, which is extremely good for this situation. Everybody would accept that. And this was all done automatically. Okay, so by automatically, I mean the problem was solved directly from flight test data to these flying parameters in one optimization run. And that's not the way it's done currently. Currently, it is done manually, one curve at a time, using oftentimes graphical techniques that do not use this approach. Okay, so this is extremely good news. It says, yes, in fact, we could go after a real problem and get directly to the data that's required for FAA certification, for example. Okay. What happens if we had what I would call lousy data? And by lousy data, I mean data where I have multiplied all of those perturbations by a factor of 100. Okay, what does 100 perturbation error mean? It means that altitudes, when I measure them, are off by plus or minus 5,000 feet. Well, since some of these trajectories are flying at 1,000 feet altitude, that means we're actually gathering data that's below the surface of the Earth. And any sensible engineer would look at that and say, that's garbage. You wouldn't even use this. Nevertheless, it's of interest to see what the mathematical technique would do in this situation. Would it be able to recover something sensible out of a problem that has really, really bad information? And the answer is, yeah, it actually does a pretty decent job. There's the basic shapes of the first two curves are pretty good. And even in the case of that third one, Ada, we've got essentially the right properties. Now, why is this important? Well, there are applications which are not flight tests, but things such as accident investigations, where you don't have good data, and where you do want to do this kind of a problem. You're trying to reconstruct something from three measurements, or measurements that may be contaminated because you're using a 30-year-old piece of radar. It's 100 miles away. And so you don't have good information, and yet you do need to make a legitimate case for the reconstruction. So what this is saying is that the technique I'm using here could actually provide something sensible in a really bad situation. So that's kind of encouraging. Okay, what I haven't told you yet is how I got the answers. And so now I'd like to talk about actually what we did to actually compute those parameter values, and that is basically the subject of the essentially the mathematical content here. How do we solve a large-scale parameter estimation problem? Okay, I'll begin with some kind of more general techniques. In fact, should mention we're using a package of software that we've developed over the past probably 10 or 15 years. It's an extension of some optimal control software. It's sold commercially as well as distributed to universities. And in there, the basic representation of a problem is much more general than the one I gave you. In particular, we deal with state equations that are any set of nonlinear ordinary differential equations that are written in explicit form. And we talk about state variables, or those are the variables that have differential or different derivatives in them. We've got algebraic variables, or sometimes they're referred to as control variables. And then we've got a set of parameters, P. And the set of parameters, P, for the example I gave you, was a vector of size 75. In the software, in our problem formulations, we'll accommodate general bounds on all the parameters, all the quantities, actually, the state variables, the control variables, and the parameters, allow for general boundary conditions at the beginning and the end of the problem, and these boundary conditions can be both equalities or inequalities. I haven't mentioned, but we have a concept which we refer to as a phase, where we actually allow the user to model chunks of a trajectory, if you will. A chunk would be a loosely description of a point where the dynamics change. Good example is when a spacecraft motor turns on and off. When the space vehicle is coasting, you'd have one set of differential equations. When the vehicle is burning, the motor is burning, you'd have a different set of differential equations. So all of these concepts can be extended to this multiple phase context. I won't get into the multi-phase applications here, but it is available. Okay. We also, in addition to that, we're going to allow path constraints. Path constraints could be equalities if we set the upper and lower bounds equal, so we would wind up solving a set of DAEs, differential algebraic equations, or they could be inequalities, in which case you'll have equalities active on subsets of the domain. I've written these path constraints in a perhaps not so obvious form, but in a form where I've isolated some terms that I'm calling analytic terms. Analytic because the unknown quantities, this vector V, which is made up of the state, control, and parameters, appears explicitly. Explicitly means it appears in the form of a linear expression. The second thing we are isolating is some quantities I call auxiliary functions. In terms of perfect generality, you could say, well, you could cover everything with one nonlinear function up here. As it turns out, there's a reason to do this that I'll exploit when we need to compute derivatives. And in particular, what we're going to be using this for is to exploit separability in the calculation of derivatives that we need in our optimization algorithm. So just mention that, and that is a computationally useful artifact. Okay, so what are we trying to do in general? What we're trying to do in general, then, is find this vector V. It's a time-varying vector or set of functions, if you will, such that we minimize a nonlinear objective function, which is made up of the sum of squares. And I've written it as 1/2 R transpose R. R is a vector of residuals. And in the software, we require a particular form for those nonlinear residuals. We write them as a weighted difference between the state quantities evaluated at a particular set of times and data at that set of times, or we allow algebraic quantities evaluated at the time and their corresponding data values. So we force the residuals to be either in terms of state or control, state or algebraic. Now, you'd perhaps think that might be a fairly restrictive assumption, but in fact, it really isn't all that bad, because you can always transform a more general application into that form. And so what I've got here is an application where we are perhaps trying to do a maximum likelihood estimate. And for example, suppose we had the likelihood objective function, which I've written up above. Well, we're trying to minimize a difference between some observed functions, G, and their corresponding data values. And typically, you would perhaps introduce some statistical characteristics in a covariance matrix. So I've written a covariance matrix in there, and noted that if it is, in fact, a covariance matrix, it's positive definite, so we can do a decomposition, a Cholesky decomposition of that, and write the covariance matrix as something like Q transpose Q. All right. If we did that, we could, in fact, then introduce a new set of algebraic variables, S, and a new algebraic equality constraint to our original dynamic system, and do the same thing with our data. So, if we make that transformation, now we're back to a DAE system, and we can impose directly a residual in terms of the new algebraic variables, which is the required form that we require, or the required form for the software implementation. So the idea is this, that any general function can be converted to, or can be made or defined to be equal to a new algebraic variable, and that algebraic variable can then be accommodated as a general residual that we're going to deal with. Okay, the basic approach that we're going to take then, and the one that we've used in all of this computational work, is the same technique that we use for solving boundary value problems, optimal control applications, and that is to transcribe the problem. We're going to convert the original continuous problem, the problem with differential equations, into a finite dimensional problem, that is a problem that has just a lot of nonlinear programming variables and constraints. So we're going to discretize the original problem. And then in having a discrete version of this problem, what we'll find is that we have a large, sparse, nonlinear programming problem, a constrained optimization problem. So we're going to need to solve a sparse nonlinear programming problem. Once we've solved that sparse NLP, we can look at the solution that we've got on our current discretization and decide if it's accurate or not. In other words, we look at the discrete solution and see, does it match or does it provide a reasonably good approximation to the continuous one that we're searching for? And if it does, we're done. If it doesn't, we're going to add some grid points, perhaps, or relocate the grid points. So we're going to do some mesh refinement here. And what that means is that the overall problem is now a big loop. It's going to consist of a sequence of NLPs. So this is kind of like a successive nonlinear programming method to solve a continuous optimization problem that has been derived from large-scale parameter estimation. Okay, one of the favorite discretization techniques, just to kind of give you an example, is an implicit Runge-Kutta scheme, Hermite-Simpson method. Basically, if we look at introducing the values of the state variables and the algebraic variables at a set of grid points distributed over the domain, then what we can do is we can replace the differential equations by a set of nonlinear algebraic equations. So what we've done is we've got a large set of nonlinear programming variables now, made up of the values of the differential variables and the algebraic variables, as well as the parameters at all these times. That's our nonlinear programming variable set, and we've got a bunch of constraints, which are the so-called defect constraints. So approximately, if we solve that algebraic equation, what we've done is the equivalent of a single implicit Runge-Kutta integration step. And so this is our integrator, if you will. Okay, now, a couple of new wrinkles have come in here because we've got to evaluate these residuals. We've got, in general, we've got data at a point, say, a sub k, that doesn't necessarily correspond to the grid points that we've introduced to solve the differential equations. So what we've got available is values of the state and algebraic quantities at the points ti and ti plus 1, and we want to evaluate a difference between measured data at some intermediate location, the theta k. Well, one of the neat properties of an implicit Runge-Kutta scheme is that it's a collocation method. Collocation method has an underlying interpolating polynomial, and the interpolating polynomial, in this case, is a cubic. The cubic comes from the fact that we know the values of the y's at the endpoints of the interval, and we've got the slopes there. So we've got four coefficients that would determine a cubic interpolant, and from that cubic interpolant, then we can evaluate the interpolant at the intermediate point, and from that evaluation construct the value we need for our residual. Okay, so you can imagine then if you have to do this at all 18,000 points, this is the part of the calculation that's going to get done, you know, to evaluate that triple summation over all those data points. Just to mention the algebraic quantities, instead of having a cubic interpolant, have a quadratic interpolant using the information available. Okay, now, there's another complication, and this turns out to be more of a bookkeeping issue than it is a theoretical one, but I think it's worth dwelling on, and that is that, remember, in our big scheme, we're going to have to refine the mesh. So we're going to start out with a coarse grid, solve an NLP, and then possibly refine the mesh. So we may be adding grid points. Furthermore, we're going to need derivatives. We're going to need first and second derivative information in order to apply an optimization technique. Well, if we look at the partial derivative of a residual on an original grid like this, you'll notice that the partial derivative here is going to depend on a value evaluated at t sub k. In other words, if we move that point around, it's going to affect the derivatives, and so the Jacobian matrix of that residual with respect to that variable is not zero. When we refine the mesh, on the other hand, we might do something like put a grid point in the middle. Now what happens? Well, no longer does the residual with respect to that variable, it no longer depends on this variable. In fact, the partial of R with respect to that variable is now zero because we've changed the mesh distribution. Okay. Mathematically, what this means is we've changed the sparsity pattern of our Jacobian matrix. And we're going to be having to deal with that change in the sparsity pattern when we actually get around to solving a sparse nonlinear programming problem. It's a bookkeeping matter. It is not anything more than that. So we just have to be careful about how we do all this. Okay. Now some kind of basics about the least squares method itself. Let's look at what we're doing versus what Gauss did 200 years ago. Okay. If we have an objective function that's 1/2 R transpose R, then just standard calculus gives you that the gradient of that objective function can be written as the product of a matrix capital R, R transpose, times the vector R. It's just the product of the first derivatives, and we call that matrix R the residual Jacobian. It's a matrix with number of rows equal to the number of data points, or the number of data values, number of columns equal to the number of variables. So this matrix is typically long and skinny. The second derivative information that we get for a problem like this involves that same matrix. And it involves a term here that includes a product of the residual and second derivatives of the residuals, as well as a matrix that's R transpose R. Okay. In terms of definitions, then, what I'm going to do is I'm going to call this guy the residual Hessian. And note that this guy is typically referred to as the normal matrix. Okay. Now, 200 years ago, Gauss said, well, hey, let's make the assumption that residual Hessian is zero. Perfectly reasonable assumption if the residuals go to zero, which is, of course, what we're trying to do. We're trying to drive that sum of squares to zero. So if the residuals go to zero, the residual Hessian will go to zero. Also true. If the residuals happen to be linear functions of the variables, then we'll have del squared R sub I being zero. And the assumption is okay in that case. All right? So Gauss's idea was, well, that's a pretty decent approximation. There's also the standard approach that's used in most packages for solving least squares software. Unfortunately, real problems have neither of these characteristics. If we knew that we had perfect data, we wouldn't have, we would have zero residuals all the time, and we wouldn't do the problem. And in fact, we've got non-zero residuals. That's why we're doing this thing. Furthermore, they're very nonlinear. And in that case, what happens is that Gauss's method becomes linearly convergent. Well, for optimizers, we know that's not good. That means lots of iterations. Number of iterations grows catastrophically large with the size of the problem. So this is bad news. Well, what we actually do is in our software, we include the residual Hessian. So we're going to be going back to what Newton did 200 years earlier than Gauss. Namely, we're going to include that guy. And we're not going to assume that the residuals go to zero and that the residuals are linear. Okay. If that's the case, then we've got to do something to compute that residual Hessian. What is commonly done, if you pick up software such as a Levenberg-Marquardt method, they would say, well, let's make the residual Hessian a multiple of the identity. Multiply an identity matrix by a so-called Levenberg parameter. That's also linearly convergent. More recently, people have thought of doing something like quasi-Newton updates to approximate the residual Hessian. A reasonable approach if you've got a small number of parameters. It's not a reasonable approach when you have 10,000 or 100,000 variables. So we actually go off and compute by finite differences the residual Hessian, and we do it using what we've referred to as sparse differencing. Now, this is perhaps my terminology. It's something that is essentially exploiting graph coloring techniques. The idea is that you can compute finite difference approximations to sparse matrices with much fewer or far fewer perturbations than there are number of variables. And that's critical in our application. It turns out that these matrices have a nice structure because of the discretization underlying it, and consequently, the number of perturbations required to compute first and second derivatives is considerably smaller than the number of variables. And by considerably smaller, I mean we're going to compute for that trajectory problem, we're going to compute derivatives in 7 or 8 perturbations for problems with 15 or 20,000 variables. That's a lot smaller. It's one reason that we can do it efficiently. It's because we can compute this efficiently, or because we can compute exploit sparsity to compute the derivatives. All right, here's where that little trick or whatever formulation technique comes in. In order to exploit sparsity in its fullest form, we actually need to write our discretization equations using a transformation of this form. And actually what we do is we construct finite difference derivatives of a function q of x and then do a simple matrix vector product to compute the actual derivative or the actual nonlinear programming constraints. That, again, exploits the sparsity that I introduced when I said I was going to handle a path constraint that had analytic terms and auxiliary functions and so forth. So, to kind of close the loop, we went through all those gymnastics in order to make the derivative calculation efficient. Okay, the second kind of computational hurdle comes in that normal matrix. Now, anybody who has looked at least squares problems know that there's a couple of bad things that can happen if you form the normal matrix explicitly. Number one, it becomes ill-conditioned. You've essentially, the condition number of that is the square of the condition number of the original problem. That can be detrimental. What's even worse, perhaps, is the fact that if R is a sparse matrix, R transpose R may be dense. So we've lost sparsity. Both of those guys are bad from a computational perspective. So we don't want to get down to solving a KKT system in our nonlinear programming algorithm that looks like this, with explicitly writing the Hessian up in the upper left corner in that form. Instead, what we do is we use a so-called sparse tableau format, where we expand it out, form a larger linear system that involves the R's spread apart, and you can show that the solution of the this form is in fact mathematically equivalent to this. The advantage, however, is that we have done neither of those bad things. We haven't formed the normal matrix, nor have we lost the advantage of sparsity. So this is a system that we can solve and use sparse linear algebra techniques to efficiently do. Okay. Now, how did all this stuff actually work on that problem I showed you? I showed all those neat pictures. What does it do for us? Well, what I've got here is kind of a brief summary of the four cases I showed you. The case where we had no error, the case where we had a typical amount of error with and without the geometry constraints on the problem, and then the really bad case over on the right. And if you look at that table, what you'd say is, well, gee, there's not much difference in any of those cases. And that's exactly right. Nothing changed, with the possible exception of line number one and the last line. So what's that telling us? It's saying that solving a problem with zero sum of squares is about the same as solving a problem with a very non-zero sum of squares in terms of the number of iterations, the number of active constraints, the number of grid points, the number of total number of residuals. So the problem size, all of this stuff remains the same, even though we went from a zero sum of squares to a non-zero sum of squares case. Why is that? Again, that's because we have a quadratically convergent method rather than a linearly convergent method, and the cost of computing derivatives isn't affected by the grid. It isn't affected by the data. Okay? Well, okay, I've been saying this is the greatest thing since canned beer, and what's wrong then with a traditional method? What was wrong with what Gauss was doing 200 years ago? Versus what a lot of other linear algebra or linear of nonlinear least squares packages might do today. And so let's look at what would happen if we applied a traditional method to a problem like this and see why it's going or why it's having such trouble. So why not consider doing a problem that I've illustrated here, where we say, okay, you've got a big black box, you're going to numerically integrate your trajectory, you're going to numerically integrate your equations, and around the outside you're going to just feed in estimates of the parameters, and out's going to fall a value for the sum of squares. Well, when you need to compute derivatives, you can just do this and finite difference the whole black box. Okay, well, one of the things that happens, of course, is if you integrate first and then differentiate, which is what we're talking about here. Now, the true x looks like the solid curve. But in fact, your calculations produce not the true x, but a numerically integrated value. So there's integration error introduced by your numerical process. And in fact, that numerical integration error does a couple of really bad things. First of all, remember, we're trying to drive the error between the data and the real truth to zero. And yet we've added error that because of the integration procedure itself. So we're contaminating our already bad data by doing that. That's one thing. What's even worse is that if you consider this problem when the number of parameters is large, like I'm talking about, maybe 100,000 parameters, it's going to produce a Jacobian matrix that is dense. So we've got a matrix that's no longer got any sparsity to it. It's expensive to compute because you've got to numerically integrate those your black box 100,000 times. And last but not least, and this is the real killer, you don't have any second derivative information unless you want to do something like a finite difference second derivative, which would be still more prohibitive and still more dense. So basically, what this says is that a traditional approach is not going to be a viable technique when we go to these very large-scale problems. Okay. So, to kind of illustrate this, I went back to what Georg Bach refers to as a notorious test problem. This is a problem that was proposed or posed originally by Boulersch from Technical University of Munich. It's a problem that has two differential equations. It's got one parameter, p, and the optimal value of the parameter p is pi. It has an analytic solution, and what we're trying to do now is to apply a standard method to integrate, you know, to solve this parameter estimation problem. Two differential equations, one parameter. Well, the first problem is that you can't even integrate those equations in a forward mode because they're unstable. So you need an extremely robust integrator, or you've got to deal with this instability in some other way. Second thing that I want to illustrate is the impact of the essentially the location of the data points on the mesh refinement procedure, and apply our new technique to this problem. And I want to do it in a way where we have essentially two different sets of data. We've got it was an analytic problem. We knew the solution. So just like our dry lab experiment, we could actually go off and construct observed data at arbitrary points. So I'm going to do it two ways. I'm going to do it one way where we put 10 data points over the interval. In the other case, I want to put 2,000 data points over the interval, and I want to spread them in a random fashion in time now and cluster them in one particular region. So what we're looking at are the results of two estimation cases on the mesh refinement history. And we're looking at the mesh refinement step size here, and you'll notice that there's almost no difference. Again, empirical demonstration that the mesh refinement procedure in our outer loop approximation is not driven by the data. It's driven by the differential equation accuracy, and that's what you want. Okay, so to kind of summarize then the story, I've talked about a numerical method that has quadratic convergence for nonlinear and non-zero residual problems, in contrast to most Gauss methods or Levenberg-Marquardt methods that did not demonstrate that. The reason we get that is we actually compute the second derivative, the Hessian matrix, explicitly, and we can do that by exploiting the sparsity in the underlying differential algebraic system. And we do that essentially using sparse finite differencing techniques. And then last but not least, actually showed the results of the algorithm on a realistic demonstration problem that would come from the aerospace industry. And in fact, that's the sales case that we're making to our own internal customers for using this particular technique. Thank you. Questions? Yes.
You mentioned when you kind of using this algorithm in find your optimization
algorithm. We're using implicit Runge-Kutta, not implicit Euler. Implicit. It's an IRK method. It's a Hermite. Actually, in fact, we're. Yeah, it's order four. Yeah, it's a Gauss-Lobato iteration, or it's a Hermite-Simpson is the sort of the generic way to think of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that you were using it.
Oh, no. Actually, it's a higher order method.